Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. And we begin with today's warning from the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres that the escalating tensions between Israel and the Iranian-backed Hezbollah movement risk turning Lebanon into another Gaza.
The risk for the conflict in the Middle East to widen is real and must be avoided. One rash move, one miscalculation, could trigger a catastrophe that goes far beyond the border and, frankly, beyond imagination. Let's be clear. The people of the region and the people of the world cannot afford Lebanon to become another Gaza.
Well, the two sides have been fighting a low-level conflict since last October, when Hezbollah began firing missiles into Israel in support of Hamas, and Israel responded with airstrikes and artillery salvos inside Lebanon. But this week, Israel announced that operational plans for a Lebanon offensive had been approved, while Hezbollah has ramped up its bellicose rhetoric, with its leader Hassan Nasrallah warning that nowhere in Israel would be safe from Hezbollah rockets in the event of a war. The United States is sufficiently concerned to have sent an envoy to Israel and Lebanon to try to defuse tensions. I spoke earlier to Dr. Matthew Levitt, the director of the Reinhardt Counterterrorism Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the author of the book, The Global Footprint of Lebanon's Party of God. I asked him if the two sides were moving closer and closer to all-out conflict.
I'm afraid they are. It's not a done deal yet, but things are as tense now as perhaps they have ever been. Hezbollah is threatening not only, as you mentioned, rockets across Israel, but to take the war to the Mediterranean Sea as well. He's threatened Cyprus because he believes that Cyprus has helped Israel in various ways. And the potential for a devastating war, both for Lebanon and for Israel, which perhaps ironically neither Lebanon nor Israel want, but Hezbollah seems eager to have, could be truly, truly devastating for both countries.
And Israel appears to be readying itself for such a conflict.
That's right. We've had almost daily rockets of different types hitting Israel fired from Lebanon by Hezbollah since October 8th. Some 70 to 90,000 Israeli civilians have been displaced from their homes. 8 months in, it's no longer economically, socially, or politically viable to allow that situation to continue. Entire families stuffed into single-room hotel rooms. The Israelis are eager to be able to start up the school year for students in the north, September 1. And they've been saying for weeks that if the diplomatic effort to get Hezbollah to stop firing and redeploy its forces 10 kilometers from the border, 10 kilometers is the far reach of the Cornet anti-tank guided missile, which Hezbollah has been firing almost daily. If the diplomatic effort doesn't work, then the Israelis would have to enforce it themselves.
Are there any restraints on Hezbollah? I mean, they are part of the government in Lebanon and are often regarded as Iran's expeditionary force in the region.
There are two sets of constraints. It's just not clear that they will be strong enough to restrain Hezbollah moving forward. The first is that Lebanon has been suffering through a political and, far more importantly, economic crisis for a very long time now. Everybody expects that a serious war, a full war between Hezbollah and Israel, would be devastating for both sides. No one in Lebanon can stomach that kind of devastation and disruption against the backdrop of so long an economic crisis. The second thing, as you mentioned, is that Iran is in many ways the proxy of Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the long arm of Iran. And as much as Iran wants to see Israel destroyed, it's been ratcheting up its nuclear efforts over the past few months, and it sees Hezbollah's rocket arsenal of some 150, 180, perhaps, different types of munitions as being its best deterrent against an Israeli or anybody else's strike against their nuclear program, and its best second strike capability should anyone carry out such a strike. So Iran has its own interest in seeing the powder kept dry, but the tensions are such that neither of those conditions may be enough to restrain Hezbollah in the moment.
I mean, why Hezbollah at this present time? Is it ramping up its bellicose rhetoric to the point where we are discussing whether or not it's preparing for open conflict with Israel? Why now?
I think the Hezbollah rhetoric is in response to Israeli statements that this is no longer going to be tolerated. 8 months of near daily rockets, just not going to be tolerated. Hezbollah has said it won't stop until the fighting stops in Gaza. There's been a deal on the table for a hostage prisoner swap and a pause or a ceasefire in Gaza. Now Hamas is not accepting a deal that was basically what Hamas had offered before. And Hezbollah is saying until there is a pause there, we won't stop. And so the Israelis are basically saying we can't let Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas in Gaza, hold all these points of leverage. We've offered Hamas a deal. They're not taking it. Without Hamas taking that deal, Hezbollah won't stop firing. And so they're making it clear they're just not going to tolerate that anymore. And I can't imagine any other country going 8 months with near daily rockets coming in and just taking it and allowing a significant portion of their country to be depopulated.
Dr. Matthew Levitt of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Well, as he alluded there, tens of thousands of Israelis have been evacuated from their homes to stay out of range of Hezbollah missiles. But tens of thousands of Lebanese have also fled theirs following Israeli strikes in southern Lebanon. Leila Al-Amin is country director for Mercy Corps in Lebanon, which works in the south of the country. I began by asking her what the areas are that have been affected by Israeli military action over the past 8 months.
Right now, there are several areas in Lebanon that have been affected. There is a big area called Beka that extends from north to the middle of Lebanon, all the east part of Lebanon, but the most affected area is South Lebanon, which is basically the border between Lebanon and Israel. And this goes from Nakura city, which is by the sea, to the Sheba farm, approximately. So we're talking around 100 villages. All the border area within 5 kilometers from the border with Israel is affected by heavy shelling every day. More or less between 20 to 30 bombing every day.
These shells presumably are directed at Hezbollah targets, are they?
So we have very little visibility on this, right? So initially, this is the official version, but the reality is that a lot of civilians are already several hundreds of casualties, wounded and killed. And you have a lot of impact on civilian infrastructure as well. There has been children killed, women killed, medical staff killed, roads destroyed, civilian habitation destroyed. The impact is also very heavily felt on civilians.
So how many people would you estimate have been forced to leave the areas that you have described by Israeli military action?
Right now, there is around 100,000 people who have been displaced from this border area, and they just moved further north in areas that are also sometimes bombed, but that are less heavily affected. But we estimate also that there are at least 60,000 civilian population that is still trapped in this area, 5 kilometers from the border, not being able to leave the villages.
And those that have been displaced, what is there for them? Do they go and stay with friends, relatives, or are there any kind of camps?
Yes, it has been absolutely amazing to see the solidarity between the population, because over 90% of people are actually hosted in other villages, not only friends and families, but really within villages where they didn't know anyone, but they just had to move and people welcomed them. What you have to remember is that in this area in Lebanon, South Lebanon, people have also been through another war in 2006 and the memory is still very much alive. So there has been this huge solidarity movement. And at the moment, we estimate that there is only between 1,000 and 2,000 people who are in what we call collective shelters, which are schools, for example, or municipal buildings that have been affected for this purpose, to welcome people who didn't find any house. The others are hosted within local communities, but we have to also remember that these local communities themselves are very vulnerable. You know, there has been an economic crisis in Lebanon since 2019. There was a World Bank report recently that estimated that about a third of the Lebanese population is now very poor. And so the people who welcomed the displaced people from the border villages are themselves not really rich. And they expected this to last only a few weeks. But now we are entering the 9th month of the conflict. So it's a very heavy burden on the local population.
So what do these displaced people and the families who are hosting them need? What is being provided by the state? What is being provided by aid agencies?
They need pretty much everything. At the beginning, there has been a lot of distribution of what we call core relief items, which is like mattresses, bed sheets, also some hygiene kits. So these can last for months, if not years. So this is fine. But all the rest, they need food simply. They need access to healthcare. They need access to education. There are over 70 schools that have been closed since the beginning of the conflict. So we have 20,000 children who are not in school. The problem is that a lot of these communities were living from agriculture. Southern Lebanon is a very agricultural area. And the harvest season is exactly when the conflict started, which is October. So they missed on the harvest of the olive groves, and now they lost all source of income. And they cannot go back to their area of origin because it has been destroyed. We estimate there is over 50,000 olive trees and other crops that have been destroyed, thousands of hectares of agricultural land that has been destroyed, also with white phosphorus bombs. So these people don't have any source of income and they rely on charity from aid agencies.
You mentioned earlier also about a large number of people still being trapped by the conflict in the south.
Yes.
Can they be reached at all?
It's very difficult to reach them because of the security. As I told you, there is bombing every day. So it would really put at risk the people who are trying to access them. There are some tentatives, though, sometimes, including with the Lebanese Red Cross. There are ways to convey the aid, but it is complicated. And what can be conveyed is, for example, food parcels. This is something that can be given to them, but it's more difficult to ensure that they have access to health or to education, right? Because the health infrastructure have been destroyed. And in their villages, there is no one left. There is few families left. So they are in a very challenging situation.
Are those people in the south, are indeed the people of Lebanon, concerned that what might be described as a low-level conflict over the past 8 or 9 months could become a much broader conflict?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, as you know, we are in a region where things can escalate very quickly. And the memory of 2006 is still very fresh in everyone's memory. And in 2006, things escalated literally overnight. So the day after October 7, I mean, October 7 already in the evening, no one could sleep in Lebanon, including myself. The two first weeks, everyone was waiting for this escalation. Thank God it didn't happen, which allowed us to prepare a bit. But still now, with all what is going on around us, people are extremely worried, of course.
That was Leila Alamin, country director for the Mercy Corps aid organization in Lebanon. Coming up, a Ukrainian brigade sent to reinforce Chasiv Yar, a key town under Russian assault in the east, says the situation has become extremely difficult. We speak to a former Ukrainian army colonel.
Ukrainian military commanders do understand the importance of Chasiv Yar. That is why they reinforce defensive forces in the Chasiv Yar as much as they could. If we are talking of Russian aims and targets over there, I may say that Russians, they lost there a lot of personnel, a lot of armament and ammunition. Despite of that, they tried to advance in the direction of Chasiv Yar.
More from Ukraine in about 20 minutes. Also this hour, four members of the billionaire Hinduja family have been handed jail sentences in Switzerland for exploiting domestic servants brought in from India. We'll have more on that story later in this edition of NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. The US state of Hawaii has agreed to take action to decarbonize its transport by 2045, but only after a lawsuit brought by 13 young people. The state settled the case in which the young plaintiffs alleged that the state had infringed their rights by prioritizing the building of roads instead of greener forms of transport. Andrea Rogers is one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs in the case. I asked her why it was felt necessary to bring it if Hawaii already had a legal goal of 2045 for reaching net zero carbon emissions.
That's right. You know, Hawaii has been one of the leaders in terms of setting goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but transportation was really the flat tire. And emissions in transportation were continuing to rise and were expected to make up most of the state's emissions in the coming years. So our Children's Trust brought this lawsuit on behalf of 13 young people in Hawaii to ensure that the Department of Transportation fixed their transportation system and aligned it with what's necessary, not only to reduce emissions, but to also protect the fundamental rights of young people to a livable climate.
And the state government has now agreed to do that.
That's correct. In a first-of-its-kind settlement agreement, the state, including Governor Green and HDOT Director Ed Sniffen, have agreed to take all actions necessary to achieve zero emissions in ground, sea, and inter-island aviation emissions, which is really exciting because it's never before been achieved. And transportation is the largest source of emissions in the United States. Transportation is the second largest source of emissions around the world, and this settlement agreement really serves as a model for other states and countries to follow to finally start tackling transportation emissions.
And the young plaintiffs, who were they? Were they climate activists?
Yeah, the young plaintiffs we represent lived, you know, on a variety of different Hawaiian islands, and they've all experienced a number of quite frankly disturbing climate change impacts. For example, one of our youngest plaintiffs, Kaliko, lives in Maui, and she lost her home in 2018 when an unprecedented hurricane hit Maui, which had never before happened, and literally picked up her home off of its foundation, and it washed down a stream. And this is something Kaliko watched and witnessed as she was at her neighbor's home. And then last year in August, her dad lost his home in the Lahaina fires. It was completely destroyed, nothing but ashes on the ground. We also represent a number of Native Hawaiian youth, many of whom have farmed and lived on their kuleana lands for generations, 10, 15 generations, and they're starting to see those lands inundated with sea level rise. Drought is causing traditional crops to be unable to be grown. A number of different impacts are affecting this community, which is, you know, one of the most isolated island chains in the Pacific.
And could this case in Hawaii be replicated, do you think, in other U.S. states?
Absolutely. And right now we represent young people in a number of different states, including in Alaska, Virginia, Utah, and in cases against the federal government, seeking protection of their fundamental rights to a safe climate. And we also support young people in other countries, including Canada and Mexico, that are similarly seeking protections. And our hope is, you know, this is the first time that government has been willing to work with kids, not against them. So our hope is that what Governor Green and HDOT Director Ed Sniffen has done will inspire leaders around the world to start not only bringing youth to the table, but really coming up with substantive, meaningful responses to what needs to be done to solve the climate crisis.
That was attorney Andrea Rogers speaking from Honolulu, Hawaii. A police watchdog in Kenya is investigating reports that a protester was shot by police during mass demonstrations against proposed tax increases in the capital, Nairobi, on Thursday. The Independent Policing Oversight Authority said it had documented the death as a result of police shooting. The 29-year-old man died at a hospital. His mother, Gillian Munyao, denounced the police for using live rounds.
If someone is fighting for his rights, why use live bullets? If he would have been found with weapons, we would have said he is undisciplined, but he was walking with his friend. For the upcoming protest, I would like to make a plea to the police. They are parents like us. The pain we are feeling is the same as the pain they would feel. I won't take revenge. I will let God fight for me.
Well, lobby groups have accused the police of using excessive force against the protesters. They said at least 200 people were injured and more than 100 arrested across the country. The BBC's Anne Soy was at Thursday's protest. How much is known about the circumstances of the young man's death?
People are still piecing together the information. And today I spoke to his mother. She wasn't at the scene, but she was among the first people to be informed of the shooting incident. And immediately she asked if he was alive or dead. And she sensed the hesitation and she said, you know, I can handle it. So she's devastated. And we met her at the city mortuary waiting for an autopsy to be conducted on his body. It had been hours of waiting. We also spoke to a friend of his who happened to be at the scene at the same time, Ian Karanja. He's 24. He told us that Rex was actually not taking part in the protests. He had been going to work. He works at a casino and he was going for the night shift. And then he got caught up in chaos as police were chasing looters who had broken into a phone shop. And that's how he got shot at. And as everyone was scampering, only one friend came back to try and help him. He tried to ask police to help him and the police declined to help, allegedly. So he called out and finally somebody else came. The police had thrown tear gas along that street and there was a hospital along that street. So it shut its doors and they managed to drag Rex to the doors of this hospital and begged them for half an hour to open. So there was a lot of time lost during that time, which they believe Rex could have been saved.
But the Independent Police Oversight Authority said it had documented the death as a result of police shooting. So an acknowledgement there that live fire was used at the protest?
That's right. There has been no question that live fire was used. The gunshot wound was seen at the hospital where he was pronounced dead. And today his mother confirmed it as well at the mortuary. She had also seen it yesterday when she got to the scene. The Independent of Police Oversight Authority is the constitutionally mandated body to investigate such incidents involving the police. And so they say that they will carry out the investigations. But I spoke to a human rights lawyer today and he said, whilst they're the right body to do that, they're not well equipped and well funded enough to really get to the bottom of such incidents as has been witnessed in the past.
What's been the reaction of those taking part in the protest? I would imagine it's made them even more determined to continue.
Yes, it has strengthened their resolve. They are angry. They say that they came out determined to carry out protests in a different way, in a peaceful way. And that's what they were saying throughout the day when I was there. They also say that later they believe other people were brought in to spoil the mood that had been there. That's when we saw vandalism along the streets. I witnessed some of that. But the protesters say they were not part of them. They only came later.
That was the BBC's Anne Soy speaking from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is News Hour. Do stay with us. A lot more to come in the next 30 minutes after a bulletin of world news.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sport Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with NewsHour, and there's growing evidence that some of our closest relatives in the animal kingdom use plants to treat themselves when they're sick or injured. In May, an orangutan in Indonesia was photographed self-medicating. In the latest study, scientists recorded chimpanzees in the forests of Uganda, which appeared to be unwell, looking for plants with antibacterial or anti-inflammatory properties. NewsHour's James Menendez has been speaking to Dr. Elodie Freiman from Oxford University, the lead researcher. She's spent 8 months with these chimps. What did she see them doing during that time?
Throughout the 8 months that I was working in the forest, I saw quite a few really interesting behaviors that the chimpanzees exhibited. One example, I think, which illustrates sort of what specifically we were looking for quite well, is we saw a subadult male chimp named Pascal, and he left the group and started eating ferns, which is a very unusual food for the chimpanzees at Bodongo. It had only been seen in the 30 years of observing the chimps. It had only been seen one other time. And this chimp, Pascal, interestingly, also had a very wounded hand. So he was clearly in a lot of discomfort. He was limping. And so that kind of tipped us off that there might be something sort of unusual. Again, none of the other members of his group ate those ferns. So that's an example of kind of one of the behaviors that we'd keep an eye out for that would raise alarm bells for
us. What did you have to do then with that fern? Take one of the ferns and then sort of test it to find out what it might have been doing?
That's exactly right. So over the course of those 8 months, we collected behavioral data on 13 different plant species. And then we collected those plant species and we shipped them off to Germany, where our colleagues in New Brandenburg did a slew of different pharmacological tests on them to see if they had antibacterial or anti-inflammatory properties. And then when we had all of that data, in addition to the health data on the chimpanzees and the behavioral data of what they were eating, we were able to kind of piece together the different clues and try to triangulate a case that these different species that we had collected were, in fact, medicines for the chimps.
Now, the key question is, how do the chimps know this and how do they learn it? I mean, do they learn it from their elders? Is this decades or centuries of experience? I mean, how?
I love this question because it's an example of something that we still don't know. If I had to put money on it, I think that there is absolutely some level of social learning going on here. So there's been some evidence that some maybe more simplistic behaviors that are self-medicative are instinctual. But I think when you get down to cases where you're talking about specific plants in specific forests that have to be eaten in specific ways, I don't think there's any instinct that would drive chimps to be able to understand that at that level. So I think there's absolutely some sort of learning happening here.
And just finally, am I right in thinking that people living in this same area in Uganda also use some of these plants for their own medication? Is that right?
That's right. So we did also interviews with traditional local healers. And I think no surprise, people who live near the forest edge absolutely know how to use the forest, how to identify medicinal plants. They've been using it for years. And we also present in our research cases not just from, Uganda, but also around the world of some of these plants being used in traditional medicine as well.
That was Dr. Elodie Freiman from Oxford University here in the UK, speaking to NewsHour's James Menendez. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. The Hindujas are Britain's wealthiest family with a net worth estimated at $47 billion. They have homes around the world, and a court in Switzerland has today handed down jail sentences to four members of the family for exploiting servants imported from their native India to work in their villa in Geneva. They were accused of paying them as little as $8 a day. The BBC's Imogen Fuchs in Geneva has been following the trial.
The Hinduja family are sometimes known as Britain's richest family. And they've built an empire and got money from things like oil and gas, healthcare even. They own the Raffles Hotel in London. They employ around 200,000 people worldwide. But for long, they have been, or part of the family, it's a pretty big family, have been resident in Geneva. Four of them, that is Prakash, his wife Kamal, and then their son Ajay and his wife Narmarat. Now, these were the four accused of trafficking and the exploitation of their servants, people who were recruited, brought over from India, and then paid very, very low wages to work in Geneva. Today was verdict day. It's been a very long trial. It's been going on for years. And the court threw out the accusation of people trafficking. It said that the people recruited from India knew where they were going, knew who they would be working for. But it did convict the Hindujas of exploitation. And the judge was quite scathing about this, saying that the family had abused their position of wealth and power to exploit very poor people, people desperate for work, to send some money back home, and some of whom were also illiterate, that they were rarely allowed to leave the house. They were working 18 to 20 hour days for something like $8 a day, which is the Geneva minimum wage is actually around $20 an hour. So, you know, you can imagine what the judge thought of the kind of wages the Hindujas were paying. Their defense said, well, look, they were getting room and board and food and stuff as well. But still, the verdict was this is exploitation, and they've been sentenced to custodial prison sentences.
How much publicity has the trial had in Switzerland? There's some combination of extreme wealth and miserliness when it comes to your servants.
Certainly, it's making headlines here this evening in Swiss media, both over in Geneva, the French-speaking part, and in the German-speaking part. And I think one of the reasons is that, particularly in Geneva, people know that this is not really a one-off case. There have been other cases of very wealthy people who live in Geneva on the side of the shores of the lake in very expensive property, exploiting and abusing their servants. You might remember, it's a good more than 10 years ago, but late Muammar Gaddafi's son Hannibal was arrested in Geneva with his wife on charges of abusing servants and of beating them. Now, those charges were eventually dropped amid a huge diplomatic spat between Switzerland and Libya. But just last year, servants working in a diplomatic mission to the United Nations in Geneva, a country's representation there, they took that country to court for saying they hadn't been paid wages for years. So it's a bit of a dirty secret here in Geneva that there's a lot of wealth, but maybe quite a lot of abuse of some very poor and vulnerable people too.
That was the BBC's Imogen Fuchs in Geneva. And let's turn now to Gaza, the source of those escalating tensions between Israel and the Hezbollah that we mentioned at the start of the programme, where living conditions are said to be deteriorating fast. That's despite what seemed like weeks or months of appeals to Israel to allow in more supplies, that's food, water, medicine, for what remains of the territory's hospitals. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, John Donison, has this report.
Along the corridor at Nasser Hospital lies five-year-old Tala. She is just about awake, but not moving. Her milky eyes roll to the back of her head. Tala is chronically dehydrated and malnourished. Her father, Ibrahim, holds her hand and tries to offer comfort, but he knows scorching weather close to 40 degrees and a lack of clean water have brought his daughter close to death.
The situation is getting worse. You can't imagine the temperature in our tent. And the water you drink is definitely contaminated, because both old and young are getting sick.
And with their houses destroyed, hundreds of thousands of Gazans are now displaced and living under canvas with little protection from the scorching sun. Getting water, whether it's clean or not, is a daily struggle. Long queues form at distribution centres. With the sewage system badly damaged and with few toilets, what water there is easily contaminated. Dr. Ahmed Al-Farri is head of the children's department at Nasser Hospital.
It is no secret that the biggest cause of intestinal infections currently occurring in the Gaza Strip is the contamination of the water supplied to these children.
But with fighting ongoing, the United Nations says two-thirds of the Strip's water and sanitation systems, poor at the best of times, have already been destroyed. Salam Sharab is a water engineer for the Khan Yunis municipality.
We need a tremendous international effort to re-establish water and sewage networks. We in Khan Yunis have lost between 170 and 200 kilometers of pipes, which have been completely destroyed, along with the wells and the water tanks.
And the most vulnerable are affected too. Yunis Jumar is 9 years old. He has cerebral palsy and epilepsy, but malnutrition and dehydration mean he's now in hospital. Stretched out on a hospital bed, semi-unconscious, his twisted small frame is hard to look at. His arms and legs like matchsticks, his knee joints bulging, his chest heaving with the skin stretched tight over his ribcage. 8 months of war in Gaza has taken its toll. Yunis is now severely dehydrated and malnourished. His mother, Khanima, standing beside him, says her son is severely dehydrated and malnourished.
When he developed his malnutrition and dehydration, he became, as you see, for almost a full week, he was too ill and stopped eating and drinking correctly.
The UN has warned more than 1 million Gazans are facing the highest level of starvation by the middle of July. The International Criminal Court prosecutor has accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon of war. Israel strongly disputes this, and its ministers have denied there is a humanitarian crisis.
John Donison reporting from Jerusalem. The hilltop town of Chasiv Yar in Ukraine's eastern Donetsk region has been the focus of fighting in recent weeks if the Russians capture the small but strategic location. It would open the way for them to make further advances into the region, notably towards the major city of Kramatorsk, 50 kilometres to the north. In the past week, Russian forces have begun storming the town from the direction of Toretsk, with Ukraine's general staff describing the situation as extremely difficult. Earlier, I spoke to former Ukrainian Colonel Sergei Grabsky and began by asking him about the strategic significance of the town.
Chasiv Yar, since the beginning of the Ukrainian-Russian war in 2014, was a key location for Ukrainian troops. Some Ukrainian headquarters were located there. Now, after a wild-scale invasion happened in February 2022, Chasiv Yar became like a forehead of Ukrainian defense on a direction to Konstantinivka.
The Ukrainian reinforcements that have been sent to Chasiv Yar are describing the fighting as extremely difficult. What's your understanding of that phrase?
That's right. Ukrainian military commanders do understand an importance of Chasiv Yar. That is why they reinforce defensive forces in the Chasiv Yar as much as they could. However, if we are talking of Russian aims and targets over there, I may say that Russians do not care actually about their losses. They lost there a lot of personnel, a lot of armament and ammunition. despite of that, they try to advance in the direction of chassis VR. They do realize that so-called window of opportunity may close quite soon, and they desperately try to advance in the direction of chassis VR.
Can we take it that the Ukrainians are finding it difficult to defend chassis VR?
Indeed, it's quite difficult because of massive concentration of forces, Russian forces, I mean, in that direction makes this defense extremely difficult. Moreover, you know, having lack of a tactical and operational level anti-aircraft assets, Ukrainian forces suffering from the severe losses due to using of a gliding bomb of Russian aviation. You should realize it's almost impossible to prevent it having almost zero aviation in place because of tactical means of anti-aircraft defense do not reach air targets, and Russians launched their bombs from the distance about 40, 70 kilometers.
I mean, you mentioned that these glide bombs are being fired from, 47 kilometers away. Could they not be disabled by these longer range missiles that the United States has supplied Ukraine with?
At this particular moment of our defensive war, I'm afraid no. Why? Because it's extremely expensive type of weapon. Moreover, we quite clearly divide so-called tactical means of anti-aircraft defense and operational and strategic means of anti-aircraft defense. And it will be too risky to deploy additional weapon, I mean anti-aircraft defense, to the front line. Because right now, don't forget, in parallel with the tactical efforts, Russian forces continue their non-stop literally every day attacks against the critical infrastructure of Ukraine and social infrastructure of Ukraine. With that regard, the Ukrainian military command should make a hard decision in which direction that weapon should be deployed. In a direction of Kharkiv, where we have like big concentration of military industry of Ukraine, or to protect our forces on the ground.
Is Ukraine still suffering from a lack of military manpower? A number of laws have been passed to try to increase the number of people, the number of fighting men. Have they got to the front lines yet?
So far, Ukrainian authority tried to do their best just to increase significantly level of mobilization. And as a report of one of our member of parliament, he mentions that over the last 2 months, in April and May, the number of mobilized personnel was more than a number of mobilized personnel during the autumn and winter 2023-2024. That is why Ukraine now desperately tried to increase strength of troops during mobilization, training and deployment of newly mobilized troops to the front line.
That was former Ukrainian Colonel Sergei Gurabsky. You're listening to NewsHour. A reminder of our top story this hour, the UN Secretary General has urged Israel and Hezbollah to stop their warlike rhetoric, saying it risked turning Lebanon into another Gaza. Earlier in the program, Dr. Matthew Levitt, the director of the Reinhardt Counterterrorism Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, told NewsHour that tensions in the region are a boiling point.
Things are as tense now as perhaps they have ever been, and Hezbollah is threatening not only rockets across Israel, but to take the war to the Mediterranean Sea.
Also this hour, 4 members of the billionaire Hinduja family have been handed jail sentence is in Switzerland for exploiting domestic servants brought in from India. And the US Supreme Court has upheld a ban on domestic abusers owning firearms in a rare victory for gun control campaigners. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. The exact number of deaths from extreme heat on this year's Hajj will probably never be known, but some estimates say that as many as 1,000 Muslim pilgrims may have died. Most of them are thought to have been unregistered, that's to say, unable to afford official Hajj permits and the air conditioning and the other comforts that registered pilgrims have paid for. One Arab diplomat has been quoted as saying that of those who died, 658 pilgrims were Egyptian. I asked the BBC's Sally Nabil in Cairo if that was what the Egyptian authorities were saying.
Nothing has been confirmed by the authorities yet. All the numbers we've been getting is from local sources and diplomats speaking to the press. But we know that more than 600 Egyptians have lost their lives so far. There are so many pilgrims unregistered in the official documents. This is why it's taking them a lot of time to give a final death toll.
And why are so many of those Egyptian pilgrims unregistered?
Because they did not go on an official Hajj visa. They went on a visitor's visa. It is a way to escape the bureaucracy and pay less money. These people, they went via local brokers who lured them into going to Mecca by paying less money, but apparently they paid their lives for it.
And being an unregistered pilgrim means, I would imagine, that you also don't get the protections from the extreme heat that registered pilgrims do.
We visited the family of a 70-year-old lady who lost her life during Hajj, and she went on a tourist visa. Her son told me that she was promised by the local broker a 5-star service, proper transportation, accommodation, medical care, everything. What happened is that the buses dropped them around 12 kilometers away from Mount Arafat, and they had to walk all the way through in a 51-degree heat. And they had no place to stay. They were staying in the street. If you are part of an official convoy, you usually stay in air-conditioned tents. You have buses to drive you around the holy sites. But even these people, they've been complaining about the lack of organization this year. The tents didn't have a proper cooling system. Toilets were not enough. There have been a lot of problems for both registered and unregistered pilgrims.
And the experience of that unregistered 70-year-old Egyptian pilgrim presumably mirrored in the experiences of others traveling from Egypt.
Absolutely, because most of the people who died from Egypt, as far as we know, they died due to exhaustion and heat strokes. We knew from first-hand accounts from pilgrims there that the emergency services were not answering their phone calls, that ambulances were not picking up dead bodies. So there was a lot of chaos, apparently, and there has been a lot of criticism for the Saudi authorities in this regard, but they haven't replied to any of that so far.
Would you expect Egypt to follow suit after Jordan announced that it's arrested travel agents suspected of organising these unregistered pilgrimages to Saudi Arabia?
Egypt is investigating, but we are not really sure that it's going to put an end to this phenomena because Hajj from this country is pretty costly. A person has to pay around $6,000. And this is a country that is financially struggling. So if we are talking about average Egyptians, they can't afford to pay this huge figure.
That was the BBC's Sally Nabil in Cairo. It's the end of the first week of campaigning for France's snap general election, the first round of which takes place Sunday week, with the decisive second round a week after that. If you recall, President Macron called the election after he was trounced by the far-right National Rally under its leaders Jordan Bardella and Marine Le Pen in the European elections earlier this month. President Macron is hoping that the vote will give him a majority in Parliament, but the omens are not looking good for him. Our correspondent Hugh Schofield has been up in the president's hometown, the cathedral city of Amiens, 160 kilometres north of Paris, to sample local opinion, which is definitely swinging away from its once favourite son and behind the far right.
OK, here we are. Now, today we've decided for once not to do the classic thing, which is to go to a picturesque, lovely market in the middle of town, but to come here on the outside of town, an ugly shopping commercial centre, hundreds of people around, because this is actually where most ordinary people do their shopping.
All I know is that today the National Rally is a party just like any other. It's a party that says it is for the French and which tries to do the maximum for the French. And we need it because, frankly, right now we're at rock bottom.
C'est le bordel en France.
France is a mess. Immigration, cost of living, nothing works. And it keeps going further downhill. Things can't get any worse than the way they are. So now is the moment to do something I have never done before and vote for the National Rally.
Yes,
sure, in the past the old National Front was scary.
they were racist or whatever. But things have totally changed. They're not like that at all now. If you ask me, the far left is more racist and more fascist than the National Rally.
The local MEP for Amiens was, until 2 weeks ago, Patricia Chagnon of the National Rally. Now she's running for Parliament in the elections which are coming up. One of those rare characters at the RN who actually speaks fluent English, she's not at all surprised by the big swing to her party here.
They should not be bullied by the EU, who is trying to impose regulations on them. They should not be bullied by the extreme left, who wants to totally open the French borders to everyone. They shouldn't be bullied by extreme liberalism. Our country has come to a grinding halt. And we represent the party who wants to put, who is going to put France back on its rails.
If the move towards the National Rally is borne out, then France is heading into completely unknown territory, with President Macron somehow having to cooperate with a prime minister from the far right. For the political scientist Bruno Courtrez, it's a recipe for instability.
If Macron first lose the election, second, that the consequence is that we have a hung parliament, many people are going to ask Macron, you should resign. Macron clearly said, I won't resign, but we could be in a situation where in the beginnings or the middle of July, it would be the Macron mandate, which is clearly on the front of the discussion.
Increasingly, here in France, it feels like the Macron era is coming to a close. It's thinking about what's going to come after that's making people very nervous.
And that report from our correspondent Hugh Schofield in France brings to an end this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.